Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Let's do it.
Born ready, pal.
Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where together we try to make sense of the day. We got this.
This is a day. It's Molly's favorite day of the week. Mine, too, except for Fridays. What do you want to know Wednesday? Your questions, our answers. A jumbo edition today because, oh, my lordy be, there's a lot going on.
It's true. We subtly hinted in that direction to our lovely and accommodating producer, Marissa Cabrera, and she made it happen. We have, this may not shock you, a bunch of election questions starting. I kind of love that the idea that somebody could write in and be like, you know, I was wondering about, you know, I don't know, vinyl siding. Anyway, we have a whole bunch of election questions. We're going to get right to it. Sung from Hawaii, who writes, now that the 2020 election is over, what happens to the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars still left in various campaign coffers?
Hoo boy. I kind of love that one. So first of all, as we have reported on Marketplace, and Kimberly actually has done some work on this as well, the Center for Responsive Politics figures $14 billion will be spent on all campaigns this cycle. That's from the top of the ticket down to sort of local magistrates and stuff. So it's a crazy amount of money. It's double what it was in 2016. So a couple of things. Number one, there's lots of money left over. So too, though, are there lots of campaign debts and bills and election lawyers. I'm sure you've seen the president is out there fundraising, as is President like Biden, although less duplicitously than the Republicans and the president, about getting more money to pay for all those lawyers. And just to pay for bills. I mean, there's a lot of money, and all the stuff that's left over can be used in multitudes of different ways, right? And that is sort of state and campaign and level of campaign dependent.
And there aren't like rules, right? It doesn't have to go back necessarily.
Oh, there are rules.
I mean,
there are rules.
There are definitely rules about how it can be spent, and it has to be spent in campaign ways. Like, you can't just go buy a car with the leftover money necessarily. But I think that there are some, there was actually a really funny Onion piece about, because so much money was raised for Amy McGrath in Kentucky in the fight against Mitch McConnell. And there was a pretty funny Onion piece that was like, you know, uses the leftover campaign money to throw the biggest end of campaign party ever. I should say that the reason that Kai says duplicitously in the case of the fundraising that's happening with the Trump campaign in particular is that the campaign is sending out this money saying we need sending out these emails soliciting donations from supporters basically for this election defense fund to defend the integrity of an election whose integrity, we should be clear, is not factually in doubt. But the fine print says that 60% of each contribution that's made will be deposited into the campaign's general election account for retirement of debt or go into the campaign's recount account if the debt has already been paid off.
Here's my favorite campaign debt
story. So not every campaign has money left is what we mean to say.
Right.
Yes.
And in fact, a lot of campaigns end owing money and it just kind of hangs out there. And my favorite example is Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House who ran for president in 2012. He still got $8.4 million in campaign debt unpaid.
Really?
Just want to, yeah.
And kinda it's crazy, and okay, so when we say unpaid, because one of the things we talked about yesterday on the show was all the people who are getting paid in this protracted legal battle, we mean that like maybe some lawyers got stiffed or some cafes that hosted events and never
vendors
got their bills paid
for, right.
Yeah.
Right.
T-shirt makers.
Visual people and screens. Yeah. That whole deal. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So not everybody pays. All right. Here's another one, and it's for you. And we've talked about this before, but I have renewed questions given the news of the day. Lots of questions about Parler. Or en français, Parler, I suppose. That's the new social media app getting a lot of attention after the election among conservatives. Here's one of the questions we got.
This is Elizabeth Honeycutt in San Antonio, Texas. My social media feeds have gone fairly quiet with regards to the election-stealing voter fraud narrative, but I'm thinking those conversations and organizing efforts have simply migrated to the newer platforms of WeMe and Parler, and I'm thinking it may have been better when we could see them. I don't know much about these new platforms, founders, background, purpose, etc. Thoughts?
That's really interesting. I've never even heard of WeMe.
Yeah, MeWe. Not WeMe.
Wow. Sorry, MeWe.
I think it's actually called MeWe. No, I think she might have called it WeMe. It's called MeWe. There's, of course, Gab. There are several of them. There's one called Newsmax. So, and actually, the people who do all the research into disinformation at Stanford call it Parlay and not Parler, and then it is really confusing. So that one I have yet to figure out is, frankly, I know more about it than I know how to pronounce it. So the deal with these platforms, just to catch everybody up, is that they were founded as, you know, much like Gab, actually, which came a long time before. Parler was founded in 2018. They are set up as these, you know, like, it's all free speech all the time. You can come here and say whatever you want, 4chan or 8chan style. They have really become these kind of like havens for, I say conservatives, but pretty right-wing conservatives who, and then they have seen dramatic growth as Facebook and Twitter have started to flag certain content and even take down, you know, content from the Boogaloo Boys or militias or doubting the integrity of the election, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the New York Times actually had a piece today about all the growth. Yes.
What do you make of Elizabeth's point that it might have been better when we could all see what was going on? Because this now is going to become a closed circle of right-wing or even extreme right-wing, never mind, I won't even try. Right-wing thought, right-wing just, you know, stuff.
Well, a couple things. One, yes, they definitely are vectors for misinformation and disinformation, without a doubt. Like, it's a place where all of your worst instincts can run free. What I will say is those places have existed already on the internet, and inevitably, the dream of an absolutely free speech place where you can say whatever you want and you never get in trouble and there's never any content moderation and nobody ever, you know, wades in and says, wow, this has gotten way too toxic. We're going to go ahead and shut this down. That dream doesn't exist. So first of all, at some point, these platforms will likely, especially, by the way, if major changes come to Section 230, and protections, liability protections that let you say whatever you want on the internet, if major changes come to 230, these platforms are going to have to do the same thing as every other platform on the internet. The other thing—
But that would—
Yes.
Go ahead. Well, but that would apply to Parler as well, or Parlay as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, at some point, these platforms that say we're all free speech all the time are going to have to say— going to face the same content moderation issues. Sorry. Yeah, like, if they incubate a shooter, they're going to be in exactly the same position that Facebook is in, full stop. Somebody like took a drink right now because they yelled bingo, because I think that's on our bingo card. And then second,
we should have that out on Fridays. We should have it in front of us.
We really should. Totally. Second, I would say there is some understanding that it's one thing to like go and play in your own sandbox, but the truth is it's boring. You can't convert anyone there. Like if you're trying to spread disinformation, it's because you want to get people on your side or you want to get in a fight. There's like no one to fight on these platforms except each other, which was pointed out by this UNC professor via Mike Isaac from the New York Times, who co-wrote one of these stories. And then Ellen Pao, who we know used to be the CEO at Reddit, waded in and was basically like, yeah, like they're probably going to start infighting. Nobody ever actually left Reddit, even though Reddit started moderating. So you can actually spread a lot of disinformation and be really, really crazy on a place like Parler or Gab. But at some point, if you want to either convert people or have somebody fun to fight with, a lib to trigger, if you will,
right,
you just got to come back to Facebook.
Got to come back. Yeah. Huh. Okay. All right.
But I guarantee they're not nice places.
Oh no, of course not. And look, part of the rough and tumble of Twitter is what keeps it energized, right? Because it's all the backbiting and fighting and, you know, all that crap that keeps it going. And yeah. Anyway.
Yep. Yep. All right, take it.
All right, I will take it. Yesterday on the pod, we talked a little bit about the presidential transition and how the General Services Administration is keeping President-elect Biden's team from getting access to office space and secure facilities to talk about classified information, also money. And we got a question about that, so here it is.
Hi, Kai. Hi, Molly. This is Steve Hajduk from Ovilla, Texas. My question is, what's the history of presidential transition teams? Is it normal to gain access this quickly after the election? Is there any precedent for what we are seeing right now? And that's three questions, so take your pick. Thanks for all you're doing.
Who, us?
Yeah, right.
I love it. We actually we went and got an expert for this one, David Marchik, the director of the Center for Presidential Transition at the Partnership for Public Services. He said, yes, this is pretty unprecedented because, as Kimberly said yesterday, the Biden team can do a lot without access, but getting access to the agencies and particularly those intelligence briefings, I found a little disturbing nugget about that I'll get to later, is really critical. Okay. First, though, to your first of three questions, dear caller, the history lesson, apparently. The modern transition started with Jimmy Carter, the first president to allocate resources, personnel, and money to transition planning. President George W. Bush had the shortest transition, 37 days, because of the recount.
This bothered President Bush for 8 years. And so about a year in advance of him leaving office, he instructed his chief of staff, Josh Bolten, to basically lay out the red carpet for whomever the next president would be. And in hindsight, that was an incredibly wise decision because when he left office, we were in the middle of two wars and we had a financial crisis. And so the collaboration between the outgoing administration and the incoming administration on the financial crisis was absolutely essential to economic recovery. It accelerated economic recovery. It saved jobs. It helped give confidence to the markets and to the American public. And that type of collaboration is essential. Fast forward to today, it would be beneficial for the country to have that type of collaboration on COVID, on the economy, on the social justice problems in our country. We face multiple crises, and collaboration between the outgoing and the incoming is absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm. Yes, just yes.
I also found out, and actually from that same guy in a conversation with PBS, but a couple other sources too, that part of the reason that may have bothered President Bush for 8 years is because the 9/11 Commission determined as part of its findings that one of the reasons that this country may have been less prepared for those attacks was, in fact, the shortened presidential transition, because there were only about half of the national security seats filled that should have been filled.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So yesterday we talked about the country being made less safe during this process, and that is an actual historical example.
Yeah. All this stuff matters. I mean, it's, you know, it depending on where you're reading and what you're seeing, it's being framed as, you know, bureaucracy, or it doesn't really matter. We got plenty of time. It actually does matter, you know, and I appreciate the president-elect trying to not make everybody crazy about it, but it matters.
Yep.
You know,
definitely. The president and Twitter, Andrew from Atlanta, writes this: I just realized that on January 20th, Twitter can ban @RealDonaldTrump.
Yeah.
Do you see this as a possibility or even a probability?
What do you think?
Nah.
How come?
No. Because Steve Bannon called for the beheading of Anthony Fauci.
Sorry to laugh.
Like, you can laugh.
Yeah.
But that happened.
Yeah.
It is one of the most appalling videos I have seen in I don't know how long. And you know who is live on Facebook today? Steve Bannon. You think any of these platforms are actually going to do anything? I mean, like, sorry, that one really.
Wait, can we back up here for a minute?
Yes.
Do I hear what you're saying?
That.
Well, no. But it's about the platform issue, right? And am I reading you right that you think after this is all said and done, and we've gone about our merry way into 2021, and the virus has receded, and we're vaccinated, and there's sanity in the White House and all of that, do you believe that that Facebook and Twitter and all the rest are going to go back to the bad old days of anything goes?
Well, I mean, it depends on how far you think they've gotten past the bad old days already, right? Like Twitter,
they've got a teensy bit past. Right.
They have gotten a teensy bit past. They have engaged on some level. Twitter, I should say, did permanently ban Steve Bannon after the beheading comments and also Alex Jones. They have been more aggressive about flagging and hiding tweets. But simultaneously, you know, you have Facebook today saying there's no way, we don't have the technical ability to enable political ads by state. For example. So they were like, we're blocking political ads before the election by state. But even though people now want to run ads in this Georgia runoff campaign, like, we can't do that. Can't do that by state, even though we made like $8 billion. So it, I think that they haven't made as much progress as I would like them to. And I think that at some point, Trump is going to be the former president of the United States. That is a a designation that that is going to be. It's going to be very, very hard for Twitter to ban him and not, you know, face the wrath.
I think
like if they stick with their own sort of newsworthy thing, I would be very, very surprised if they banned him.
Fair enough. I'll buy that.
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. All right. So we're going to get into some of the propositions around the country, specifically California. Prop 22, which we talked about, I think, on this podcast. Voters approved it here in California. It exempts Uber and Lyft drivers from a new law we have out here, which we've talked about, called AB 5, which would have forced Uber and Lyft to classify their drivers as employees instead of contractors. Anyway, Karen in San Francisco has a question.
Hi, friends. This is Karen in San Francisco. I'm wondering about the passing of Proposition 22 in California. What does that mean for the non-rideshare and delivery sectors that were inadvertently affected by and are now left held to AB 5? I'm thinking about the theater artists, health aides, housekeepers, freelancers, and others who weren't granted exemptions and whose opportunities are now being limited by AB 5.
Yeah, I've got a friend who's a lighting designer, a theater lighting designer. And he's like, no, man, this was killing me. And I need relief just like the Uber drivers do. So it's, you know, it's one of those unintended consequences things with this law.
AB 5 was really broad, it's true. And they did, I mean, this is important because there was basically a new bill, AB 2257, that attempted to kind of make it a little bit easier. It made provisions for musicians, specifically vocalists, photographers, and some other services, youth sports coaches, apparently, and pool cleaners. Also, freelance writers, photographers, and illustrators wouldn't be subject to some of those limits. So, so first of all, the state has tried to limit the damage of AB 5. And Prop 22 really specifically refers to app-based driving and delivery. So it's pretty much drivers. Like, I think it's pretty narrow in that regard. Yeah. And so other freelancers are less likely to be kind of swept up in it. It has a whole bunch of other potential unintended consequences, but I don't think that's one of them. I could be wrong.
Crystal ball this thing for me, if you would, on the theory that, you know, as California goes, so goes the nation. Do you see a bunch of, I mean, after AB 5 passed, I was like, oh, man, a bunch of other states are going to do AB 5. And then there was Prop 22, and I was like, oh, man, a bunch of other states are going to do Prop 22 now. Where do you see that tug of war, you know?
Yeah, I think both. Like, some states are already considering AB 5-style laws, and there was an op-ed the other day in New York that was arguing for a Prop 22-type law. I feel like Prop 22, you know, despite the kind of shady origins, or at least the fact that it was very self-serving and these companies, like, bought it, spent $180 million on that campaign in California.
Yeah, for sure.
That the fundamental argument that the bill made, which is that we need kind of a third way for labor law, that it, you know, something in between just total full-time employment, this is the deal, this is your salary, the end, 8 to 5, and, you know, hanging in the wind, working whatever hours you want, but having zero protection, that that actually makes sense. We probably do need a third way type of designation that does protect workers and allow for a future of work that we're already pursuing. So I think there's a chance we'll see that spread.
Do you know of any? I mean, do you know of a third way, you know, plan or anything?
Well, that's what Prop 22 is in some ways. Yeah, no. So Prop 22 says that these companies can continue to, classify their employees as independent contractors. So it keeps the classification in place, but it says that they have to do so with a wage floor and with some, like they have to have a guaranteed wage that's higher than minimum wage, and that they will provide some funds, almost like vouchers, like a voucher system for health insurance, and that the amount that you get will go up the more you drive. So if they follow on that,
right,
it's meager.
That'd be good. I was going to say it seems like a, you know, 2.5 way or a 2.25 way, not quite the full third way, if I could just torture
the
metaphor.
It's a start.
Right.
It is a start that is very much in the company's interests, but hopefully some other state can do better.
Well, they're getting what they pay for, right? They wanted it, they paid for it, they're getting for it. All right, this, I believe, is the end, after that little start metaphor right there, of our What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Questions, comments, make me smart at marketplace.org. Voice memos, please, because they're better. They're just better.
Yep.
They're just better.
They're good radio.
You know, they are better radio.
Thank you to those of you who sent them in. Thank you to those of you who have served our great nation, like one Kai Rizdal on this Veterans Day, which also happens to be my dad's birthday.
Well,
just throwing that out there. Happy birthday, Dad. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and Make Me Smart skill on your smart device.
Ben Tolliday engineered today. He also composed the theme music, as you know, with Daniel Ramirez. Donna Tam is in charge. Star Nieves does whatever executive directors of On Demand do. I don't know. I don't know.
A lot of
Zooms. Honestly,
someday
somebody's going to have to tell
me.
A lot of Zooms. I had a Zoom with her.
A lot of Zooms.
She was pretty good at it, you know.
I know. She always looks so put together.
Whatever. I know. Now she's slacking me, telling
me. Executive producer means you, or director means you have to put on earrings for your Zooms.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.